for me, trust is this really, it's an intentional risk to like bear your authentic self. And then in turn, you hope you feel like supported and understanding. And I think trust develops from this sense of like two factors, and both of those factors come from self-awareness. And those factors are like vulnerability and consistency.
Welcome back to Paths to Purpose. Thank you guys so much again for joining us. Today, we're excited to dive deep into the topic of trust, which is something we have mentioned a lot in our previous episodes. Alan, do you want to start by just talking about a course that you teach? You teach an interpersonal dynamics course at Cambridge. Can you share more about what trust means to you and why it is such an important element in engaging in projects and meeting people who resonate with your purpose?
Yeah, Danielle, I'm happy to do that. Trust is fundamentally an authentic relationship. So it's the ability to actually really respect and communicate authentically with somebody else. And it's sort of, again, it has an emotional resonance. It's the ability to rely on somebody. And in a work concept, in a career concept, we have to imagine that we're extremely busy and we really care deeply about a particular project. And in that environment, we really want somebody who's going to deliver for us. And so the trust element in that context is that if I'm extremely busy, I literally hate people wasting my time. So if I'm extremely busy, I want to trust that you're going to come into the project and work with me, and you're not going to eat up a whole lot of time, and you're going to deliver high quality work. And there's a book called The Thin Book of Trust, which actually discusses four core elements of trust, which include sincerity, care, reliability, and competency. So those are kind of the elements of trust that I think of.
Mm-hmm. Great points. And I think Lauren, our guest today, kind of touches on all of these. So without further ado, we're going to get into her interview. We are very excited to have Lauren Kozowski with us this week, who also happens to be one of my best friends. Lauren is currently a third through fifth grade teacher at Stanley British Primary School in Denver, Colorado. She was previously a Teach for America Corps member, working with students from some of the most at-risk neighborhoods in inner city Denver, where she had to earn trust from skeptical students and some students who had suffered trauma. Lauren is also currently receiving her master's degree in education at Harvard. And fun fact, Lauren is also a yoga instructor and teaches some of the most challenging fitness classes I have ever taken. Lauren, welcome to Paths to Purpose, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
But can we kind of start out by talking a little bit more about your job currently and how you got there?
Yeah, of course. I am currently a third through fifth grade teacher, and I was originally hired to do intervention work. So working to kind of fill in holes, both social emotional learning and then also literacy and math. And I got there kind of just through this idea of a path to purpose, of figuring out what is it that really, it was through the question of what makes me angry. And what made me viscerally angry was children not having access to a creative, critical education and having so many populations within the US that weren't receiving that day to day. And so that's kind of how I entered education. I made a pivot from medicine and science and then fell in love with kind of the complexity of education and the craft of teaching. And so I've been teaching for 5 years since then.
Phenomenal. And can you kind of go back a little bit and talk about how you did find that purpose? And you talked, or you just shared that it was about kind of what pisses you off, and how did you kind of get to that point?
Yeah. And so I think like a lot of people, I was in a major, I was in a science major, because I feel like a lot of time too, in terms of when you are a passionate and intellectual woman, you feel like there's a very narrow sense of what majors you can take in terms of where you'll be respected and have a seat at the table. And so I felt like I was very much pigeonholed into either like science or math or law. And those were my options in order to be able to have a table open for me to sit at and for my voice to be heard. And so I was in a science major, and I love the nuances and cycles of science, but it didn't have the interpersonal connection that I was craving. And so I was kind of just lost in going through these classes, and I stumbled upon Alan, and thankfully he asked me that question of what makes you angry. And I realized that it was this idea of the inequities in which learning is such a fundamental right, and being able to be a lifelong learner is what matters most in this world. To critically analyze and question our environment is what every student and every person needs in this kind of especially in this world today. And so that is what I realized made me angry. And so from there, I went into Teach for America and wanted to kind of, I began studying just the theories of education and pedagogical strategies that are successful and wanted to create those environments that I knew were successful for kids. So kids having a chance to question and communicate and collaborate and be creative and to really explore their passions. And I went into Teach for America and started teaching sixth grade math at a second chance school in a middle school in Colorado Springs, and quickly realized that education is only possible when children feel safe. And so when we employ trauma and sensitive practices into the classroom, and we think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And that we're only able to access higher learning and creative thinking once that first foundation is met, which is, do I feel safe? And so much of my work then pivoted to how can I create learning environments where students can question and communicate and collaborate, but through providing them with tools so that they can self-regulate and advocate. And that's in turn to create these lifelong learners who are compassionate and also really critical citizens that invest in their passions and communities. Because that's when education is sustainable, is when kids go back into communities and realize like, ah, oh, there's a problem here, I want to fix it. And I know how to do that because I can regulate my emotions and because I can advocate for myself and others.
So Lauren, thanks for joining us. This is Alan. I appreciate your time this morning. I recall when you started getting involved with these kids, one of the things that you had mentioned was that they were not able to learn. And you mentioned it in this previous conversation that they weren't able to learn because many of them had been traumatized. So what we wanted to learn from you was a little bit about trust, because in order for you to get access to that, how did you identify that this was a core problem? And then how did you get beyond that? And then how did you earn trust with them?
Yeah, those are a lot of great questions there. I think in terms of recognizing trauma, that is because I also am a survivor. And so I could really clearly recognize kind of PTSD from experience. And I think that applies to a lot of things in terms of when we think about what empathy does, is empathy allows us that ability to step into someone else's shoes and to fully understand it. And so that is in where I was really easily able to recognize trauma. And I think when I think about trust, I've been thinking a lot about what that means. And for me, trust is this really, it's an intentional risk to like bear your authentic self. And then in turn, you hope you feel like supported and understanding. And I think trust develops from this sense of like two factors, and both of those factors come from self-awareness. And those factors are like vulnerability and consistency. And so when I look at like creating trust with kids, those are the things that I'm bringing. I'm constantly bringing like this sense of vulnerability of where we're switching the hierarchy. Because in education, we think about so often the teacher is posed in this expert role and students in this novice role. And so much of it has to, in order to be completely vulnerable, at times teachers need to shift that and completely pivot it on its head and go through the process of learning and being a novice with their students. So students observe me making mistakes and they observe me admitting to them and kind of gracefully acknowledging that we're all human. And this is a process that we all go through. And in turn, when children see that, they also feel more at home to make those mistakes themselves. And then it's also just consistently showing up for kids. Because when we think about trauma, it so often hijacks our brain into thinking that we're unsafe. That's what it does, right? Our amygdala, that fight or flight response, is firing. And so when a child is traumatized, it is more likely to fire. And so one of the most important things is to create a classroom that is consistent. And one of the easiest ways to do that is through the teacher, actually. And through the teacher every single day, exhibiting the same behavior so that the child comes in and they know what mood the teacher is going to be in, they know how the teacher is going to discipline. And so when they show up, they know, oh, I know what Miss K is going to do, or I know what Miss Edwards is going to do in this situation. And so they feel safe and then can begin to develop a relationship. But it's not until they see that, oh, this person is consistent, they're fair, that they'll begin to even start to trust. And I think trust is really foundational because it promotes a feeling of security. And that's the sense of security that's needed to access higher learning.
So this sounds like you have a very heavy, deep commitment into this. And so one of the questions I have, do you get overwhelmed and how do you deal with that?
It's a great question. I think, yes, there's so much urgency. And a lot of times there's almost a life or death kind of feeling in terms of how important education is and how important literacy is and all of those things. And so that can feel overwhelming. And I think I ground myself in the sense of every single day I have the chance to show up and connect with kids. And then that's what matters. And that connection then in turn builds that sense of trust. And both my students and myself heal from that trust. And it's that kind of like reciprocal process that is so grounding in a job that can feel so overwhelming, because some days you're working with 85 children, right? And the first school that I was working at, 75% of those children had 3 or more adverse childhood experiences. And so that's a threshold where that lifelong risks and health outcomes are severely impacted. And so the world of school becomes places of triggers. And so we think about the importance of one caring adult relationship and mentor and how much that builds resilience within trauma backgrounds. And so, yes, I think it is incredibly overwhelming, but isn't that an important part of purpose? Of if there isn't something that is overwhelming and something that is feels greater than yourself, then I don't know if it's the right job. But there should be moments where it's debilitating, the sense of, oh my gosh, right? That this is unbelievable, the stakes that we're in. But for me, that's what drives me. That bigger question of how is it that we can support so that every kid can learn, that matters.
Absolutely. Can you kind of talk a little bit more about, you gave a little bit of background on coming in and showing up consistently and how that kind of enables students to then show up authentically and be vulnerable in your classroom. And I know just from being your friend that you have worked really hard on social emotional learning. And you mentioned that in passing when you were kind of giving your overview of what you do. Can you kind of explain more about what social emotional learning is and like how that enables you to build that authenticity in your classroom and why it's so important?
Yes, thank you for asking this question, Dani. I think social emotional learning is a really hot topic buzzword in education, and it's really wildly and widely used. And so I think it's really important when we talk about creating impact that we have specific lexicons and language that everyone can sink their teeth into to understand our impact. And so social emotional learning encompasses a lot of things. And so it's important to kind of break down what those things are. And so it's the specific skills and competencies that students need in order to set goals. So we're talking like executive functioning type of skills. It's also the skills that they need to manage their behavior, to interpret the behavior of those around them, to build relationships, and to process and remember information. So when we're thinking about SEL, is this huge term that encompasses all of those kind of facets and nuances that make children and adults successful in school and in their workplace. And it's all kind of like the behind the scenes. So in order to turn in that paper, you probably need to build relationships with your peers and your teachers. You need to be able to plan long-term. You need to be able to complete assignments. All of those are social emotional skills. And we typically think that those kind of just happen naturally, but they're not. They're really intentional in terms of how we model and how we selectively create curriculum or kind of co-regulate with our students to build those. And so, yeah, I think curriculum is really tricky. And I really firmly believe that social emotional learning happens best when it's actually through direct modeling of a teacher, because so much of social emotional learning happens through what we call attunement. So a child watching an adult and observing what they're doing. And from that observation, they create their own knowledge and their own behavior. And so it's so important that when we're talking of social emotional learning, before a child can regulate on their own, they have to observe an adult do that skill. And before an adult can do that, adults actually have to have incredibly high social emotional competency so that we think about co-regulating before regulating. And so essentially teachers need to be able to self-regulate before they can co-regulate with their students. And that's something that I've become incredibly passionate about. And that's the same concept that we keep talking about with this idea of trust and consistency of, in order for me to self-regulate, I have to have a firm understanding of self. And it's actually a very like direct process in which we model for kids of saying, I'm frustrated right now. I'm going to choose to take a deep breath, like take one with me, let's do it together. And then from that, I regulate and my children regulate with me. That's co-regulation. And that's essential to social emotional learning. Was that rest of your question, Danny?
Yeah, I think that it's, to me, I mean, just from being your friend and from talking about this with you, I know how passionate you are about it, but it also, to me, I've learned so much just from hearing you kind of describe social emotional learning, because it seems like it's a lot about self-awareness and about emotional intelligence to some extent. And those are all things that I, as an adult, I hear a lot, but that were never in my education, like really focused on or implemented so directly in the ways that you're doing that in your classroom. But it's something that even, again, as an adult, that you really have to be intentional about learning and putting into practice. And I think it all kind of goes into this idea of building trust and showing up for people. It starts with yourself, is what I'm hearing from you. And that's something that I think will resonate with anyone in any career, is just that idea of being able to communicate about your needs and plan ahead and do all the things that you just said. That's not something that stops when you're a child in a classroom.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So Lauren, I'm going to pick up on this competency thing that you talked about, and particularly with respect to this emotional competency, because Charles Feltman has a thin book of trust, and he talks about reliability, sincerity, care, and competency as the core elements, which completely align with what you had just said. But with respect to this emotional awareness and the ability to earn trust, are you a unicorn? Is it being taught? How are these skills being developed? Do other teachers? I mean, one of my concerns, I think Danielle shares this concern, we don't pay teachers enough. Are we giving them the proper skills and the training to get there? And how does one earn competency in this space so that you can earn the trust within the classroom?
Yeah, wow, that's, yeah, right there with you of not getting paid enough. I live it, I experience it, totally understand it. I think I was raised in a household where my mom was a Reiki instructor and a yoga teacher. And so energy has always been so much more than just like a theory of relativity. It's like this palpable life force, and our ability to feel it and understand it has something that has been constantly kind of embedded in who I am. And so in order to kind of like pick up on energetic cues or social cues, so much of that comes from deep self-work. And self-work is really terrifying. It is hard to sit and kind of trudge through it and sit with all the yucky things. It's so much easier to run away from it, but it's through like sitting and understanding ourselves that we're able to even begin to access our empathy for others and recognize those signals in other people. And so I think so much of how we build this skill, so it's not just in one classroom or in one person, that it's kind of more transferable, is in giving teachers a chance to kind of go through that work of like, how is it that we self-regulate? How is it that when I feel triggered, because it is completely normal to feel that way, how is it that I can address those emotions in a really empathetic way? So that my students go through that process with me and begin to understand. And so I think you're right in terms of how is it that we extend the impact? And it's a lot of through professional development, or I hope through professional development through teachers. And so I work on writing kind of small, they're called kernels out of the lab, Easel lab at Harvard. And we write small little digestible kind of learning targets. They're not curriculum. They're just simply like, these are bite-sized pieces of social emotional learning that teachers can implement everywhere, because it's less that social emotional learning has to happen within a block, right? We're not talking like social emotional learning doesn't happen in 45 minutes where we're crammed and it's not standards aligned. That's not what social emotional learning is. Social emotional learning is kind of in every nuance of your classroom. It's living, it's breathing, and it's actually more about how you tie it across disciplines. And so it becomes so much more of like a mindset. And so when we think about this, it's so much of equipping teachers with a common language that can be used from kindergarten through 12th grade, so that kids are consistently hearing the same things and consistently visualizing and seeing consistent behavior and interactions from teachers. So I think it's so much of training teachers to have a similar kind of understanding of social emotional learning, and also a consistent understanding of self and giving that space to process that.
I think that I'm sitting here like listening, processing everything that you're saying, and it's really getting back to this idea of constantly building this muscle, even as an adult. Even, you know, it's a lifelong journey of, you know, establishing trust within a classroom, within a boardroom, whatever space that you're in involves constantly doing the work and showing up authentically and being willing to work on things, because they don't change overnight and they aren't something that's just gonna, like establishing trust with another person or with a group of people is something that takes time and patience. And I just think that that's something that you emulate so much in your own life, is just continuing to do the work and to do the things that will resonate with your students, but also your friends, your family. And that's just something that I really admire about you. I don't have a question about that. I just wanted to say that following up what you just said.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you bring up a really interesting point of when we think about impact and purpose. Part of the reason that work is so hard is because you're changing systems. And when you change systems, you're met with constant resistance. That's what change is. And resistance is, oh my goodness, so challenging. And so I think about the importance of, you also talked about friends and families and loved ones, of if you're constantly encountering resistance and you're intentionally embarking on that, because that's what change is. And that's what we hope our jobs have enough purpose to kind of employ, that mindset of I'm going to hit resistance and I'm going to continue to fight for what I know that is right. We need people in our corner. We have to build coalitions. We have to build communities, and that's essential. And so I think part of purpose is we think of it as a silo. We think of it as I am by myself in this journey of purpose. And it's not at all like that. I'm going to have to figure out how to change the system by myself. And it becomes just this tunnel vision. And it's really isolating. And we think also we live in this independent, individualistic kind of Western world where that is so emphasized too, of that I. But so much of purpose is actually found in the conversations with others and in building that community and understanding, oh my gosh, there's more people that think like this. I'm not crazy. And then having that support to continuously do the work. So it's not that I like have a special power at all. It's actually that I really heavily rely on people around me to do the work with me, because you're right, it is so hard.
So that highlights a point that I want to bring home though. I mean, we talk a lot about people as far as the last word in our puzzle here, because we're doing purpose projects and people. The problem with, or something that I want to make clear to the audience based on what you just said, sometimes the family and the colleagues, our friends, our normal friends, are the resistance, because they think we're crazy going down these purpose paths, because they're much easier paths, they're much more, you know, financially viable paths. And often they're the noise in our heads fighting us on what we need to be doing. So what I think is important, and maybe you can talk to how you find the people you're talking about, the collaborative people, is how do I tune those people out, and how do I find the people with whom I actually want to have these dialogues?
Yes. And wow, that's a tough question. I think that also kind of brings up this idea of imposter syndrome. I think imposter syndrome is this sense of that we all experience it, and it's this actual lack of trust within ourselves, right? That's what, when it boils down to, that's what it is. And I think that insecurity and distrust within ourselves starts to develop when we hear those voices, especially yes, from the ones we care most about. Mm-hmm. And that's when we begin to doubt. And those voices become louder typically in the times when we're most unstable, because typically we seek those voices of loved ones when we're transitioning. And in transition, those voices, those doubtful voices come full force. And that's when I've experienced the most doubt within myself and experienced that idea of imposter syndrome. And the best way I feel like of combating imposter syndrome that I have found is to kind of recommit to this idea of why did I start this work and who trusts me. So if imposter syndrome is this distrust of myself, to combat it, we think about how is it that people trust me? What do they know? What do they like love and adore about me? And then sitting into that, okay, I know Alan or Danielle, trust me for these reasons, they would have me in their community and they would have me in their corner. What are those reasons? And it's re-sinking into that, that I'm able to kind of refine my footing.
I would add, trust me and understand the purpose about me and aren't trying to fit me into their sense of purpose about me. That's really important to me, because oftentimes people trust you, but they think that you should go down a different path that's in their head and not what's in your head.
Yeah, I think that that's something that probably Lauren and I have both experienced in our just school experiences thus far, but also just, yeah, you constantly have this doubt. And like Lauren said, there's lots of ways to combat that, but finding the people that will be in your corner for your reasons that will make you a more impactful and better person, that's who you want in your community. Lauren, we're running out of time on this episode, but I did want to ask if you had any resources that you would want to share with our listeners about all the things that you've talked about today, about trust and being authentic and being vulnerable.
Yeah, I think in terms of building trust, the most important thing is to find those things that refill your cup, because the idea of stepping into vulnerable relationships, because trust asks us to risk it all. I like to think of it as that intentional risk. And if you're taking an intentional risk, I guess I would say the biggest resource here is, yeah, for me, refilling my cup is reading an amazing book and going on a long run. But I think whatever resource that allows you to refill so that you can recommit to this cycle of really vulnerably exposing and opening your heart, and in turn, hoping that people around you do the same. I'm trying to think of if there's a book that has kind of, For me, I always recommend How the Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Vanderkolk, because it has so much of this understanding of how our bodies interpret in the language of trauma. And so that's one I always recommend, but I'll have to think about that, Danny, and maybe I'll have to send it to you and we can post it later on Instagram, because I'm like so overwhelmed with resources where right now I'm like, I don't know. I feel like right now, especially in a pandemic, we all need a cup of tea and a book.
Absolutely. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today and sharing your story, being vulnerable with us and with our listeners. Thanks again for listening. We hope you guys have been enjoying this series. Let us know how you guys are working through things, or is anything confusing? Are you feeling stuck? We want to know how this is resonating with you, or if we're missing the mark. So please let us know how we're doing. We'd love all your feedback. If you have questions or if you want to give us feedback, our Instagram is @PathsToPurposePod. Number 2 Purpose Pod, or our email is paths2@gmail.com, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.